Let's talk about the Incredible Hulk. His alter ego, Dr. Bruce Banner, grew up with a lifetime of unresolved trauma, which manifested itself in fits of rage. If something or someone triggered him, he would turn into a giant green beast and smash stuff. And as his outwardly muscular appearance shows you, his internal demons were strong. Now imagine being Doc Samson, the genius psychiatrist. You're constantly battling the Hulk. You take hit after hit, and whether you win or lose, boy, do you feel beat up at the end of the day. So now transition to real life. You're helping kids working through substance use or mental health issues. They're outwardly expressing their emotions, oftentimes in uncontrolled ways. And I'm gonna go out on a limb and guess that you haven't tried the muscle building craze of gamma radiation yet. So naturally, you might feel burnt out. But don't worry, it's totally normal to feel this way. And Sans Don't Care is here to help. I'm Clint Malley, and this is Real Common Treatable, where we help behavioral health professionals stay at the forefront of adolescent mental health, addiction, and substance use treatment. So in this episode, we're going to talk about burnout, specifically for professionals working with adolescents and their parents. We'll talk through the experiences of treating adolescents in a residential setting, 4 steps that you can take in guiding the family through a successful treatment process, and tips to help you avoid burnout. We've got a great teacher today, Amanda Porter, a licensed professional counselor and the program director at the Sans Don't Care Cascade Canyon Teen Center. So let's get right to it and hear why working with adolescents can be sometimes a little challenging.
There's such a difference between working in the adult population and working in the adolescent population. And I think for me, it's that brain development piece. For, I always say specifically, like, adolescents are challenging in like a surprising way, because the adults, you could just be like, you need to go to group, and they'll say no, and you'll be like, no, you really have to go to group. It's what is socially expected of you right now. And they'll just be like, okay. With an adolescent, you'll be like, you need to go to group. And they'll say no. And you'll be like, no, you really need to go to group. And then they'll just say no. And so I think that's a different dynamic, is that the prefrontal cortex is just not developed enough to have enough of that like social awareness of like, you actually have to go along with like society and the rules and stuff like that. So you have to get more creative and more persuasive, and definitely more like accommodating on how to approach the teen population. People come in here kicking and screaming, and so the big challenge is moving it from that external motivator to an internal motivator. And like you said, the doors aren't locked, they can leave anytime, and sometimes on some days it surprises me that they're all still here at the end of the day. But I think what we do is we try to make it as interactive as possible and just try to continuously hit on like this like choices and consequences, like your decisions. And that's part of that like brain development piece, right? Like, they don't always recognize that like my decisions and the way I interact with the world has like a direct outcome for myself and for the people around me. And so I think getting them to move to that like internal motivation piece, it's through like a series of interactions. It's through that one-on-one care. And you would actually be really surprised how much the teens care. They really do care like what other people think of them. And so I think like just continuously putting out there that message of, we care about you, we love you, like we're doing what we can do to help you, and now we need you to help yourself. We're going to give you all the tools that we can, and you're going to get all this information, but it's going to be up to you. And so when they can see over a period of time us investing in them, they slowly move from that external like, what, my parents made me come do this, to this, other people are investing in me. It's not just my parents pushing me in this direction, and I actually want to start investing in myself because I see my value and I see my worth.
So it sounds like the choice to change really needs to come from the adolescent themselves. And different levels of care provide guiding support in varying ways. This is why it's important to match the level of care to the intensity of the struggle and the needs of the client.
At the residential level of care, we're like crisis stabilization. And so we're doing our best to get people out of the crisis for which they presented to treatment and get them moved on to the next levels of care. I know that it's recovery, long-term, like stabilized mental health and stabilized addiction is about, it's what they do after they leave here. Like, we're gonna get the skills into them and get them the information they need, but like long-term recovery is like 99% what they do after they leave here. So I think a lot of times it's just that perspective of we're just cramming as much knowledge and information into this person and setting them up for success in the best possible way. I think aside from the fact that what this intense like level of care provides is that you get to take, whereas in an outpatient center, it might take you 3 years to amass this knowledge, we're gonna get it all condensed into this shorter time frame. And so you might go to therapy in an outpatient setting 1 hour a week. Here you're getting 5 hours of clinical contact a day. And so you're getting just like these like hugely condensed, like intensive level of like education. So I think that in and of itself is beneficial. And I also think the most beneficial part of being in residential is we are here, the whole staff, everybody from the clinical team, nursing department, our behavioral health technicians, we're set up to notice patterns in people, to point those patterns out, and to help them correct those patterns. You do not get that in an outpatient setting where they come in and they go to a group and then they leave and all their patterns are at home. It's really easy for someone to pull it together and present really well for a 3-hour group in an outpatient setting. Here, you can present really well for 3 hours in your afternoon group, but then you have to go to dinner with all your peers and you have to go through evening programming with all of your peers. You have to endure conflict. You have to yell at people. You have to be corrected on that. And so your patterns in a residential setting, like you get to see those snippets of personality, those quirks that need to be tweaked a little bit, the things that, you know, are going to really set them up for success. And so you get that intense level of change that you really wouldn't see at other levels of care. And you get to watch them implement these habits and establish new patterns and get to take those things back into their life. So I think just the observation piece alone is awesome at the residential level of care.
I don't know about y'all, but I want to hear an example of what it looks like when an adolescent enters treatment angry and destructive, and then leaves treatment having developed healthier patterns and successfully working through their problems.
Adolescent that left on Halloween actually was their discharge date, but they came in kicking and screaming and like physically kicking like the things around the property, and there were a lot of issues with property destruction on the front end, and I had to have several conversations with this person. Do you want to be here? Do you want to do this? If you want to do this, like I will be here and I will support you the entire way. But bro, if you don't want to do it, let's just go. Like, let's figure out a different placement option. We're not trying to hold you here. And so it was through those like small conversations of investing in this person where I finally start to see that they're not just like a rageful, angry kid. Like, he was actually terrified to go home. He didn't think he would be successful in reintegrating back into his family environment, into his school environment. And so he was creating like all that like psychic tension, and that anxiety was coming out in these episodes of like property destruction and just like huge swaths of impulsivity. And I remember one day he like smashed one of our mailboxes over here off the wall, and they were actually having group here, and I had to go out there and I was like, come with me. And so we went for a walk. We found that walks were really helpful. So if we could just take a break, that was something that was really helpful to this kiddo. But I just remember it seemed like over time, it was so easy to intervene and change that mood and get him refocused, and like to see the change from the first couple days where it was like an hour, 2 hours in these individual sessions to kind of like convince him that he wanted to be here and that he wanted to do this, to something as simple as like, you've just smashed something, let's just walk down the driveway and walk back up, and now you've cooled down and you can reintegrate and get back into your life. And yeah, it was really cool because by the time that they were getting ready to leave, we had actually slated a 30-day stay for this person, and they requested to stay longer, which is really, it's mind-blowing for a kid to advocate for themselves in that way and to be like, I need more of this, I want more of this, this is working for me and I want to get as much as possible. And so we extended their stay out to 45 days and they were able to successfully reintegrate back into their home. And yeah, the transformation was incredible.
When an adolescent is acting out, it is important to immediately point out the destructive behavior to them. Bringing attention to the negative patterns of behavior makes the client aware of what they are doing, which then allows them to actively work on changing.
So the kid that I was talking about before with the mailbox smashing the first couple days, perfect angel. And then once they settled, that's when like the true colors start to show and you really get to see the symptoms of anxiety, the symptoms of depression, the way that these mental health disorders are presenting. And then you're able to bring them aside and be like, hey, did you know you do this? Because I think a lot of times for the teen population, they're actually just not even aware due to developmentally, they're not aware of these patterns. Like when you're able to pull them aside, they have a rough family session and then they go in back into the milieu, into the group of the kids, and they start to process out loud with them. And then other people are able, the staff can overhear the way they're processing with their peers. And then you get to say, that's not even close to what happened. And so then you're able to pull them aside and be like, did you know you just reframed this in an entirely different way? Let's talk about perception. And so you get to see the after effects of therapeutic services. You get to see like how they're processing in their friend group, as well as how they're presenting in with their therapist, with authority figures in the house. And so it's really cool to see that dynamic and be able to correct in the moment and it not be in like a punitive way, just more of like a, hey, heads up, were you aware of this for yourself? And then a lot of times they'll just be like, no, it's just how I've always done this thing. And you're like, oh, cool. If you change just like one little thing, like your whole life could be benefited. And so I think I love the observation and the connectivity of the residential setting.
Now that we know some major benefits to residential treatment, let's get into the 4 steps that you can take to guide the adolescent and their parents in creating a healthy environment that makes for positive change. Number 1 is that you need to keep an objective mindset and be an advocate.
By the point that somebody is getting to residential care, so many things had to go wrong for them to get to this point. And I think that a lot of times they just need an advocate. And so I tell myself that's my role in the treatment setting. I just want to be the person that it can show up in their life and be like, you know what, you're all right. Because I think a lot of times when people come into residential level of care, it's just, you have to do this, you need to go here, like you need to follow these rules. It's especially for the teen population, very seldom are they self-referrals. It's not often that the kids are being like, hey, I need help and I wanna go to treatment and I wanna do this. It's like a lot of people pushing them in that direction. So I just try to take as being an advocate for them. And so I think for me, that's really how I avoid being jaded in this treatment setting. And just in my role in general as program director is like always playing devil's advocate. People are so quick to pick up on the negative or to focus on what's wrong with somebody or what do we need to fix or change. And I'm like, let's look at what they're doing. Let's look at how they're progressing well. And let's focus on the positives of this individual and just have compassion for the struggle.
Number 2 is to remove any negativity from the situation.
It's my number one goal is to take the negative spin off of any interaction that I have with them. Even if it's signing an improvement plan, which is like our write-up system here, they're coming to me and I'm like, okay, so this didn't go great. And you know that we cannot continue with this specific behavior. So I'm going to have you sign an improvement plan. They're like, I'm not signing this. And they get all indignant about it. But I was like, hey, listen, like your fight's not with me. We just have to get something on this piece of paper. When somebody is saying, oh, this, you know, they can't do it, or if a kid themselves is saying, I can't do it, or I won't do it. And I'm like, let's just look at it from the other lens. And I think for me, that's that creativity piece is just being able to look at it from a different lens. And yeah, you're saying this and you're saying you can't, or you're saying you won't, you're saying you're not able to, you can't get out of bed and go to group. And I was like, what would it be like if we just did? What would that world look like if we got up right now and we went there? What's the worst possible thing that could happen? And just running through all those scenarios. So how can we take the negativity out of this? What in this dynamic do you actually want to work on? What is it that you even want to change? Is there something you want to change? Help me fill this out. And so I think for me, when I think about being an advocate, I think about being collaborative with the kiddo to move them forward, and definitely just trying to, like I said, take any negative spin off of those interactions, because they've probably had a lot of negativity in their life leading up to this point.
Number 3 is to help the adolescent set healthy and positive goals for themselves.
So we can have the positive and the negative goals. So they can have those negative goals. I want someone to stop doing something. You don't have control over so-and-so. So what can you do? How can we frame that goal in a positive way? What can you do to get that autonomy goals? Because actually, if we look at developmentally, like where these kids are, like it's one of the 2 main tasks of adolescence. Like first we have identity formation, which is like the younger adolescent trying to figure out who I am. And then the later adolescent is their like biologically supposed to be trying to transition into autonomy and transition away from that parental control. And so that's a lot of that push and pull that we see in that later adolescence is them like just doing what they're supposed to do. And so like they're supposed to be pulling away from parents, they're supposed to be getting ready to launch into the world, go to college, do all those kinds of things. So for us, a lot of times it's about wrapping back around to goals. It's just about how do we frame that in a more positive thing. So instead of saying, I want my parents to leave me alone, I want to successfully launch. I want to take steps to, you know, successfully integrate into a college environment, or I want to, how do I gain independence? How do I work towards independence? How do I work towards repairing trust that will allow me the space to make my own decisions? Or like, how do I make healthy decisions to, so instead of taking, again, just taking that like negativity out of it, we can take that same goal, which is, hey, if you build trust and you work towards independence and you accomplish A, B, and C, like I bet your parents will give you more space to like make these decisions and launch successfully. And we can work on A, B, and C instead of the goal of get them to leave me alone.
So far, we've worked on ourselves as professionals and we've helped the adolescent positively change their outlook. This is major progress, but the adolescent is going to eventually return to their home environment. And we want to keep all this forward progress that we've made, which brings us to number 4, help prepare parents for successful life at home.
Any source of attention is attention. So like when you were saying when you got crickets and nobody was paying attention, it's maybe I need to turn the dial up to 11 to get attention. So what we find is if you can reinforce the positive stuff of, man, thank you for sitting quietly, or you really handled that phone call, or look how good your grades are doing, or hey, you, I love the way you resolve conflict there. Giving them that positive reinforcement can go like so far, because they're getting the attention that they crave and that they want, and they're getting it in a positive way versus kiddos having to seek out negative ways to get that social or family attention. I think what we see actually be more beneficial than the punishment side of things is like positive reinforcement. So promoting, giving them praise for the things that you want them to do. I like to use the example, I used to teach a parenting class actually, and I used to give the example, like when your toddler's like sitting quietly in a room, like coloring, like you're not gonna go in there and be like, oh my God, this is the best thing in the entire world. Even though it's exactly the behavior that you want and it's exactly the behavior you appreciate, we don't really give a lot of like verbal like reinforcement of like, good job, you're doing great. It's just like ignored, like, oh my God, don't disturb them. Everyone be quiet, they're doing what we're supposed to do. Like, but what happens a lot is they get that overt verbal like recognition when there's something negative that happens and when it comes out in like a punishing way. Kids have to have consequences, and I think that they should have the natural consequences. Like your choices will have consequences, and this is like a natural progression of how your behavior will show up. But the problem is to kids and to teens, like that stifling nature of just like completely suppressing all like experience or creativity or like movement towards independence, it just does not work. What's the old adage, because I said so, never works. The kids are at this age, they're so curious, they want to know why. You have to have a rationale and a reason for like why you're implementing boundary or structure, because just that whole because I said so, I've seen that a lot of times. It never goes well, because then the kid believes there's no like structure behind it, or there's no like actual rationale or reason behind it. But I think we can see it on both sides. You can see like the entirely like suppressive parenting style, and then you can see like way too permissive and like way too enabling parenting style, to where you can actually start to promote like mental health disorders and promote like the addiction like exacerbation, because there's just no boundary at all, or there's no limits set for the kid, and there's like way too much autonomy. So I think it's about finding a balance.
I feel like there's a really fine line with these things. When am I being too lenient, and when do I need to give more freedom? So let's introduce you to the green, yellow, red technique. This technique helps to define boundaries based on the quality of decisions that the adolescent is making at home. So without further ado, green means go.
I actually like one of the therapeutic techniques that we use here a lot. So it's called green, yellow, red, and it's actually a contract between the adolescent and the parents. That's like a collaborative process. So we have, if we have these green behaviors, which are like positive behaviors moving in a good direction, then the teen gets these permissions, less strict boundaries. And so it's a way to, the kid knows exactly what behaviors put them in the green lane. The parent knows exactly what behaviors put them in the green lane. And it's a collaborative process to say, I'm coming home on time, or I'm notifying you, whatever boundaries they want to put in place. Like, I put my phone up on a dock at 10 p.m., whatever it is. And if I'm doing these things, then I get more autonomy. I get more independence.
Yellow means caution. Slow down. Set some more boundaries. Which kind of makes me feel like I shouldn't be speeding through that yellow light. Weird.
And we have the yellow lane, which is like things to be cautious about. I was 30 minutes late getting home. I didn't call to notify anybody. Or I got a grade that wasn't something that I'm normally accustomed to. If I'm normally getting B's, suddenly I got a D in this class. And so these are things where we just want to be a little bit more cautious. And then at that point, there's also a set of boundaries that go along with that. So they start to have, now we're putting the phone up at 9 p.m. or now we need to be home an hour earlier, or we're going to make sure that we maybe don't get to go out on Saturday, these kinds of things. So we have a little bit more restrictive boundaries put into place. But again, both sides are very clear on like what this looks like, and we've set this up ahead of time, because I think for each kid it could be different, right? Some families may not care so much about tracking whereabouts, where other families, it's very important to them. So it's a very customized thing.
Red means stop. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200. But do create more restrictions and boundaries.
And then of course you've got the red bag. I went to my IOP group and I did my drug test, and suddenly I'm positive for marijuana. And I'd been telling people that I wasn't using marijuana at all. And so now I'm gonna have some big restrictions and some big boundaries put into place. And so I think using a contract like that and having boundaries that kind of ebb and flow with the behavior is a really good way for parents to know when they're on track and when they're headed down the right path. Because everybody says like, you do your best, but your best changes from moment to moment. So some days kids are gonna be in the green lane, they're gonna need green boundaries, and some days they're gonna be in the red lane, they're gonna need red boundaries.
Now we know when to create and take away restrictions, but what do these restrictions actually look like? Let's take a look at aftercare boundaries. The adolescent just returned home from treatment.
I think aftercare is super important. I think it's 99% like what kids are doing after here that sets them up for success in the future. So I think a lot of boundaries surrounding attendance of aftercare and engagement in aftercare is really important. So making sure that they're getting to IOP appointments or therapy appointments, that they're engaging in that process. So I think I really like it to see boundaries related to that. Like, you're expected to be at these three IOP groups through the week and you miss one and now we're in the yellow lane. And so we might need to see about supplementing with a community self-help meeting to make up for the fact that we did that. So really staying on top of like the aftercare and that kind of structure. And then you want to create structure surrounding like school and other activities. So if they're involved in like sports or if they're involved in extracurriculars, making sure that they have adequate attendance on that end of things. And then the standard things that the kids typically care a ton about, which is gonna be like the car usage and the phone usage. And so making sure that we have good boundaries there to help them build back up trust, because a lot of times they're using the phone inappropriately, or they're using the car to like get places that are inappropriate. And so making sure that we have boundaries of, hey, if you're in the green lane, full access to your car, full trust, like we move forward with it. If you're using those things inappropriately, then you're gonna have restrictions on those types of items. And I'm always a big advocate of making sure that they're being guided in the correct, like positive way on like social media outlets as well, that they're not using those things for negative purposes and negative connections.
Congratulations, you've successfully led the adolescent and the parents down a strong recovery path. But as a professional interacting with struggling adolescents, your job doesn't end when a client goes home. You have a constant rotation of this, and sometimes this can be tough to deal with. Because of this, it is important to be conscious of your mindset and stay ahead of the game when it comes to burnout. You must take care of yourself so that you can healthily support other people.
I remember when I was like brand new, super green therapist, like going through and teaching groups. It was like, I was learning the content along with people. I was like, oh, that's how you manage anger. Oh, that's how, this is actually really cool stuff. So I remember going through that process, and one of the groups that I taught was like on stress management. And I got really super into this like stress management class, and it's just two handouts that I just have carried with me for 12 years at this point. But the biggest thing that I loved about it was titrating expectations. Because when you like set the bar up here and then all your clients are coming in here, like that whole space is disappointment and it's anger. And it's that's when you start to personalize stuff and just get really bent out of shape. But it's if I expect that kid to knock the like mailbox off the wall, then it's like, okay. So you just expect to meet people where they're at. You expect for the clients to be unwell, to be progressing towards a healthy lifestyle, to be trying to better themselves. But you also expect, you just have to expect the crazy behavior, and you have to know that you're working in a chaotic environment. And when you titrate that expectation, like it's, I think it's just much easier to know. I'm not expecting some like peaceful sit in my office for 8 hours a day, like position. Like I'm expecting to do one insurance form and then have to go get a kid from the end of the driveway and bring them back up to the top of the driveway. I expect the chaos. And I think for me, that's what really helps with my own personal like sanity and my self-care, is just to know like I signed up for this. I know people aren't well when they're here, and I expect them to act accordingly. And then if we have a lovely day, then it's a lovely day and it's a pleasant surprise. But it doesn't like it, you don't get bent out of shape when there's so many bad days. These aren't like years long clients where there has to be longevity to it, and there is a constant rotation. I think that for me helps with the burnout, because it is a new challenge so frequently, like the cases are so frequently changing out. You feel like you're not encountering the same issues or the same refusals or the same pushback. Like you're getting a new challenge every single day in this field, which I think for me helps with burnout, because every single day there's something new.
We've worked through a lot today and hopefully gave you a better idea of how to help clients, but also a roadmap for self-care. Listen, y'all, burnout is real, but it is also more common than you think. And thankfully, with the support of professionals like you, it's also treatable. So let's empower somebody today, but also take the time to empower yourself. All of my love, and I will see you on the next episode.